To me, it was, how do you build a business that's scalable and bring good people around you that you don't have to quote unquote babysit and let it run? And that's what I did. Since 2012, I think we've grown almost 30 times. That's how much we've grown in that amount of time, by letting people do what they should be doing and staying out of the way.
Welcome to the Better People Podcast. I'm Holly DePalma. And in today's episode, we will be talking to Dave Mattson, who is the CEO and president of Sandler Training. Welcome, David. Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Holly. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. As I said, when you when we met on the call, I was surprised you weren't in UConn blue and silver. This is a banner time for UConn right now.
I know it is. It is. And as I mentioned, I have five children and they all happen to go to a different school. So that's what you see here today, right?
You're still representing.
All the texts were written to. Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. Well, thank you again for joining us. I'm sure you're super busy. I would like to just outline a little bit of our conversation. We're going to start. I'd love to learn a little bit about your career. I think something very unique in today's world is your career has been built essentially in one organization. And I'm dying to sort of learn a little bit more about that. And then talk a little bit about your leadership philosophy and some of your lessons learned, and really then finish with some advice for leaders and aspiring developing leaders. So with that, obviously, from our intro, you went to UConn and then shortly thereafter started working with, it looks like, a Sandler franchise. Am I correct?
Yeah. So and all the way right out of high school and into college, I actually was painting houses, to believe it or not. And then I was never going to go into business. My parents were teachers. That was not my destiny. And, you know, I was working for teachers. Teachers, that's what they do in the summers, right? And I always remember somebody gave me a $4,600 check to give to the teachers for painting the house. And we would do two houses a week. And he had a couple crews. And I realized, well, wait a minute now. I'm making $275. The person next to me is making $275. You're making about $9,500 a week. That's a good deal. And so next thing I know, I was paying attention and actually asking questions. And next thing you know, next year I had crews working for me, and I did that for 6 years, all through college. And that's, you know, I've been working my whole life. I grew up in a family where you could have anything that you want, but you have to pay for it. And that's how I grew up. And so when I was out of college, to your point, I went to work for a Sandler client, actually, because I'm introverted by nature. My parents weren't, you know, I wasn't around the business world. And so I went to work for a client. And believe it or not, I'm going to age myself now. They sold office machines, like typewriters. Like, I don't even know if they have typewriters anymore, Holly. And
I think they do, but they're like, you know, sort of on
museums.
Display.
Yeah, they're in museums. Yeah. And the big claim to fame was just his memory. So that, you know, long before we had computers. And so they were Sandler clients. And I was resisting. I was one of those people in the back of the room with the arms folded, like, I need to get out of here. And then I realized that they taught basically communication skills and psychology. And so I gravitated towards that. And then I became their number one salesperson. And then I went to work for a local trainer of Sandler, because I said, well, the best way to become a machine is to work for the machine. And I was already a Sandler person. I was, you know, I was a groupie already. And I went to work for them for a couple of years and then had the opportunity to meet Dave Sandler. I happened to be the only salesperson in the country at that point in time, so I kind of stuck out. And in 1994, I went down to work for Dave Sandler. And that was a family-owned business. I was the non-family member. And he and I got along great. I became his protege. I bought 25% of the business in 1995. And then David passed away, and I bought 25% in 94. David passed away in 95, which was, from a business perspective, that's a different topic. But for me personally, that was not a good situation, because my protege, I was the protege. My mentor had passed. All the family members now are looking at me saying, now it's our turn. And so it was a dark 10 years, to be honest. And in hindsight, I'm not even sure why I was there. But then I ended up buying out their family members in 2007. I bought another 50%, and then I bought everybody out in 2012. And so that's kind of the journey through time here.
Got it. Got it. And so you held various roles, some in operations. Was that during the dark times, if you will?
Yeah. So I ran the our channel. So I trained all the channel, ran the channel. Then I went into enterprise or global accounts. I ran that group. And so I obviously I've been successfully fired from every role within Sandler. So there isn't really anything that goes on here that I haven't done. So it gives me good insight.
So let's talk about developing the business. It's had tremendous growth. Certainly under your leadership, it's had incredible growth. Talk to me about what that meant for you and building a team.
Well, in our industry, the flaw in our industry is it revolves around the figurehead, right? So if you think about in the training world, whether it's Tommy Hopkins or Zig Ziglar or anybody, when they decide to hang it up, the business is dead. So the first thing was, how do you scale the business and how does it not revolve around me? Now, David Sandler was a genius because he did not revolve around David. It was called the Sandler Selling System, but he made sure that he was never the figurehead. And I perpetuated that to make sure that I was not going to be all roads led to David. Now, not from an operational perspective, but from the outside perception where the business was built around myself. I never wanted that. And so for me, I always knew that I was going to ultimately sell that business. So I wasn't going to die there. I wasn't bringing in family members. As I said, I was in a family business with Sandler's and I didn't want to go through that again. And so to me, it was, how do you build a business that's scalable and bring good people around you that you don't have to quote unquote babysit and let it run? And that's what I did. And so we've, since 2012, I think we've grown almost 30 times. And that's how much we've grown in that amount of time, by letting people do what they should be doing and staying out of the way, to be honest.
That's incredible. That's incredible. So tell me about, you know, sort of the leadership team that you put in place, not necessarily who it was, but what were the roles and how did you identify who was going to be the right person for that job?
So that's a big question. So the first thing that we did is I believe you should create a plan. Mm-hmm. Then you should create the positions that are necessary to fulfill that plan. Mm-hmm. The third thing that you should do is go find the right people. I think the big mistakes that leaders make is they look at their current people and say, where would they fit? Mm-hmm. I think that's a huge mistake. That actually helped me because, you know, once you develop the plan and figure out, okay, well, these are the positions that I need to actually fulfill it, then it became very apparent that I had some people already that would be great. And I had huge, huge holes. And so my current structure would be, you know, we have a whole group that supports our channel. You know, so we've got the typical accounting, legal, and all that good stuff goes on. But then you've got a group of trainers, you know, you have a group of salespeople. And I have two models. I have a channel model, which goes after our small to medium sized businesses. And then the large multinational companies, we go direct.
Okay.
And so we have two distinct organizations operating under the same intellectual property. And so we try to leverage it as much as we can on either side, but we try to operate, you know, as independently as possible so we can make good decisions for that side of the business. And I think one of the challenges that I had, Holly, was deciding at some point, do you go after talent or do you stay and hang on to legacy knowledge? Because the painful part is there are certain parts of your growth that you've outgrown the people that got you there. And, you know, I learned a very good lesson from the CEO of Splunk. No one's ever heard of it, but it's a multi-billion-dollar company. And then we were doing all of their training. And I was at a sales kickoff. And I see all these new names of executives popping up. And I went up to him, the CEO, and I said, boy, it seems like your whole leadership has changed. The whole bench has changed. And he said, it's true. And I do that every 5 years or so because I'm going to get talent that has actually built businesses to the next level up. So hypothetically, let's just say I'm doing $1 billion. I'm looking for somebody that's run a $3 billion group, and they're going to drag me up because I can't push every individual up to $3 billion. Now, that's not my numbers, and that's not a lot of numbers for the listeners, but the philosophy always stuck with me. I'm like, well, that is so true. Instead of pushing people to become way past the PETA principle, you just have to make at some point in time, thank them for what they've done and you know, help them find another spot with or without your company. But you've got to go find talent that's going to take you to that next level. And that's what I did.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I run our predictive index practice, which is a, you know, an assessment business. Mm-hmm. And we talk a lot about head, heart, and briefcase, right? Which are the distinct, and that legacy employee is got that heavy, heavy briefcase. And they probably have the heart, which is, I'm super committed to this organization, mm-hmm. but I might not have what I might, my briefcase might be filled with some of the wrong stuff, right? Because I don't know how to run a $3 billion business, and my head might not be the right fit in terms of entrepreneurialism and those kinds of, you know, sort of risk-taking ways of working. That's really, tell me about the sort of the hardest lesson learned in that. Was there a situation that you had where you had the absolute wrong person in a job?
Well, I mean, I think there's a bunch. There's a bunch of different scenarios. One, I had the wrong person at the job because before I just became disciplined on position first, person second, put them there because they've been with me for so long. And I pride myself on being super loyal. And so I kept in there longer than they should, which was a disservice to my customers, to them personally, because it didn't end well, and to the company. Mm-hmm. And that was a good lesson for me to do that. But I've brought in people from, let's say, you know, like LinkedIn. I brought in some high flyers over at LinkedIn who should have been able to do what I needed to do. But culturally, we were just disconnected because I need doers and thinkers, not just thinkers, right? I don't have an army like 50,000 people over at LinkedIn as an example. So you're going to have to do both. And I, even though you can say that in an interview, and I'm a huge believer in assessments as well, it's push comes to shove. They get there and there was no doing. There's just a lot of thinking. And you know,
this is so funny or interesting because you met the CEO of the Mid-Atlantic Employers Association, who I work for. Yeah. And he and I have been working together for about 10 years, maybe a little more. And I make him, we sometimes interview people together, and I make him so uncomfortable in interviewing because I say, when somebody says, oh, we did this, I say, I want to know, what did you do? I don't want to know what the company did. Tell me your role in that experience, because your company, and you're absolutely right. And this is such an interesting mindset. And I call it the mid-market, where we don't have people to sit around doing. I think Charles Barkley said there's five real jobs, like firemen, doctors, nurses, police, and everybody else is just like, you know, I want to know what you did. What did you do? That's interesting.
Well, I mean, I think if you're looking for people, and listen, everybody's a master of pronouns, right? The we's and the, but it wasn't the I's. But I think as I'm looking for people, I'm looking in categories. And I use this acronym, you know, but I'm looking for skills, right? I use search. It's what skills do they have now that I can apply to this job? What experiences do they have that would be applicable to this job? What's their attitude? Like, what's their mindset, right? What results have they currently have that would dictate that they would succeed at my job? What's their process and cognitive skills, and what are their habits? And, you know, ultimately they're going to fall down on a bunch of those, but you've really got to pay attention to all of them and not fall in love with, you know, the person sitting in front of you, because, you know, everybody's Tom Cruise on an interview until you hire him. And then here comes Rodney Dangerfield. You're like, what just happened to this person? Like, I don't even know this person, but they're going to retire on your payroll. And, you know, to like that LinkedIn example, they were there for 3 days. And I said, this is not going to work out. And I know it. Really? And I'm not even, 3 days. I knew it immediately. Because I'm a huge proponent on the interview process, not to blow smoke at you, to tell you all the reasons why this is going to be a hard job and all the reasons why you may not want this job. Because I always succeed when people say, it's not as bad as you said, David. Versus, oh, you're going to love the job. This is the greatest. People love us here. You know, everyone's happy. You know, blah, blah, blah. And they get there and they're like, it's not true. It's kind of like, you know, on a first date and you got catfished, I think is the term they use. You know, that's, you know, I like to just say, this is the job, take it or leave it, but this is what we have. And it's not going to necessarily change because I want you so badly.
Yeah. Tell me, let's talk about interviewing. So this is another thing. And I have always said, and I believe this, hire slow, fire fast. Like, you know, when you know, you know. And just like you said, 3 days, this is not working.
Yeah.
But from the hiring perspective, we tend to fall in love and we get, you know, it's like that first date giggles, like where you're like, is the perfect person. And, you know, I'm talking, coaching my 17-year-old through this. But even as, you know, very seasoned leaders, what do you do in your interviewing process to make sure that, you know, that the right steps to vet your search process is followed through? Because one of the things I love about Sandler, and I have taken Sandler, is process. I'm bad at process, so putting one in place can be really helpful.
So for us, I use the search model, right? I do use the skills, and I'm going through those questions. I do assess, so I assess early. You know, I'm a big believer in looking below the iceberg in that. I am a big believer in having multiple people interview. However, multiple interviews without a good pre-brief and debrief is worthless. So if you're not going to share information like, okay, Holly, here are the two or three areas that I think may be an issue, but I didn't uncover enough, you should pick up on that topic. If I don't tell you that, you're going to ask the same questions I asked, right? And we're all going to fall in love with the same reasons. And if it's an important job, I like to fly in and take, if they have a partner or spouse, I'll take them all to dinner. Because I learn more there than I learn anywhere. You know, I had somebody that really had to be on the road 40% of the time. And I went to dinner. And it happened to be a gentleman. And I said to his spouse, I said, so, you know, how do you feel about Rick traveling 40% of the time? Rick's not going to travel 40% of the time. I said, okay, well, tell me a little bit about that. I mean, what does that mean? Blah, blah, blah. He's traveled. And it was done at dinner. It was over. And had I not figured that out, because here's the interesting thing about interviewing. That person desperately wants the job and desperately wants to prove to you that it's the right person, right? And so do we. We want to make sure that we made the right hire. And I think then the second big tragedy is because most people think a dead head is better than no head. Because with that gap, I'm going to end up having, like, if I was a sales manager, I'm going to have to go and produce for that quota. Otherwise, I got to go hire somebody. So this is a C player. And so I'll fix them. That never works out. And the second thing is, you know, the longer you have them, the harder it is to fire them. So that's just fact, right? Because, you know, let's just use salespeople here. I got a 9-month sales cycle. They didn't hit their first cycle of hitting quota, but I'm saying, you know, they're almost there. I put a lot of time and energy into them. They're going to get a lot better. That never actually happens. I mean, like, it just never happens. And I think if you have a good onboarding program, and which is a sales focused onboarding program, not a typical one, you can weed people out in the first 60 days. Because to me, I mean, I'm happy to share with you, there's like four parts of a good onboarding program that you can smoke out who should be in your company and who should not be in your company pretty quickly if you follow it.
Yeah, I want to talk about that onboarding. I think that's pretty fascinating. But I have two other questions about interviewing. Talk to me about interviewing or hiring for potential. Where somebody, they weren't a C player, they were an A player, but they might not have had that briefcase that, as you called, the skills or experiences that they were, that was needed. But they had the attitude, the results, and all of their experiences they had the cognitive and the habits mm-hmm. that I believe were the other parts yeah. of search. Tell me about developing or making a decision on that person.
Well, I always look for in your current jobs, you know, so what are the experiences, skills, and competencies you need in your current job to become 100% successful? The AP are now working on the next job. Like, what experiences do I need? What skills should I have in order to get to that next job? They may not have it now, mm-hmm. but they're always preparing for it. So as far as talent is concerned or future bench strength, you know, so if they don't have that experience or they don't have the results because they haven't done it yet, then it's really an appetite for learning. It's an appetite for being vulnerable. It's an appetite for really being honest about where you are and where the gaps are. And if you can see a trend of somebody that really wants to step up, is willing, because I always manage people with three P's, permission, potency, and protection. I'll protect you. You can tell me what's what. I'll protect you. You don't have to be afraid, right? I do have the potency, and I'm giving you permission to tell me the truth and to fail, frankly. And most people get very nervous about telling the truth to their employer because they think they're supposed to be this 24-hour stud or studette. And that's right. just not the case. The reason why I got along with Sandler is I would say, I messed up right here. I don't know what just happened. I mean, honestly, I just don't know what happened here. And then right. because I'm brutally honest, that was disarmingly honest. Then I think that's the people that are willing to be molded and willing to do what it takes to get to that next level. When you have somebody that is in their mind so buttoned up and, you know, they're entitled to that job, then I think that that's a bit of a stretch for me. So I'm always looking for people that have that mindset, that mindset of always learning, super vulnerable, do what it takes, are accountable for what they say. They're going to do what they say. Then I'll take a shot at those people all day long. And, you know, and there aren't that many people. Well, I like my father. There aren't as many as I would like to have them around that kind of show those characteristics.
That always creeps in our parents. And yeah, my parents really are teachers too. So this could get a little scary. But So talk to me about the development, if you will, around, you know, you talked about onboarding, which is certainly the first step of that development is getting somebody into your organization. So I'd love to learn yeah. about your onboarding philosophy, but also then the development of from a leadership perspective.
So I think I can tie them into the same explanation because philosophically it's the same. You're onboarding a new job is quite frankly, you should create a list. And of all the things that they need to know or be able to do to be 100% successful at that job. That sounds super simple, but a lot of companies don't have that. They just don't have it. Like, what does it take to be successful in that role? What is it? And then the second thing you should do is put in order of priority, because everything doesn't have to happen immediately, right? There's certain mm-hmm. things that don't happen until year two, for example. And then give them an example. So, you know, if I'm talking to about a sales leader, that's an example. And one of the things that they had to learn was do like pre-call planner with a person. We just use that as an example. Then you should give them a sample of what a good pre-call planner looks like and how to do it, and actually show them a sales manager with a person actually doing it, because adults learn by imitation and illustration. They mimic. And so for you to go and say, create your process. It's the blind leading the blind. As an employer, you should say, this is the way it's done. I want you to mimic this, put your own personality, twists and turns. But this is an example of what I think is a successful way to do that. Now, what I'm doing is I'm telling them what it takes. I'm showing them an example. And then I come back and say, now do one to me. So do it to me. Show it to me. And what is that person doing all week? Holly, I promise you, they're practicing all week. So they're practicing actually what I think it takes to be successful. They're building confidence because they know now they can do this, right? And so they're building confidence as well. So when I'm building that future leader, I'm coming up with a list of, when you have this role, these are the most important things that you have to conquer and to learn and to implement. And here's an example of how those things are done. And so let's do them together. And I think when people hear what they say and they're practicing and they do all those things, you're really developing a culture of accountability, because you're saying, show it to me. But you are developing what I'll call a sales culture or a leadership culture, and you're actually helping people jumpstart where they're supposed to be versus you're awesome at your current job. Therefore, I know you have the competencies to be awesome at the next job. And I think that's a huge disservice to those who they're managing and themselves and the company.
Yeah, you know, you just gave me a great tip in that you just basically talked about role playing without using the phrase role playing, because people hate that phrase. But yeah. When I do leadership development, or do especially teaching, you know, moving a manager to a leader is a real, real hard shift. And a lot of that is involved with a different mindset.
Yeah.
And you can instill a mindset through practice.
Yeah. And I think that the problem with most leaders is that they actually make you do the role play. And I think that's just very unfair. I think that one of the greatest things that Sandler did to me, and I do to our people, is, well, how are you going to attack this problem? Like, what's your thought? What are you going to do? And they have to explain it to me, right? And I had to put a lot of thought into it, because I knew Sandler was going to ask me, like, how are you going to go about this? And so he forced me to have it my idea. Now, he would edit my idea, but it was always my idea. It wasn't him telling me what to do.
Right.
And then the thing that I do, which is reverse role play almost, is to say, Holly, you know, you've got a difficult conversation coming up. You haven't done one of those before. So let's kind of go over the steps and how to do that. Would you like me to do one to you the way I just described it? And I actually do it to you. So you're the leader playing employee, mm-hmm. and you mm-hmm. get to experience and hear it versus me saying, so Holly, you got a difficult conversation tomorrow. Let me see you do that. You'd be like, well, I don't even know what I'm doing. It puts everybody in an unfair position. But for me to do it to you, then you can mimic back. Then again, I'm role playing, but I'm leading the role play, which I think is what you need to do as a leader, not for somebody who's never done it to wing it in front of their employer. It's high risk. It's just unfair, and you don't get what you want. So why would even do it?
Is this along the lines of the guardrails that you would give leaders? Talk to me about the guardrails that you give leaders.
Well, I think to get the most out of people, you have to create guardrails. Otherwise, everyone's afraid to do anything, or they're not doing what you want them to do. And so when it comes to any topic, you know, they know how I think about it. Let me share my thoughts. This is how I would operate in this parameter. And you have, listen, this is your project. You have total control of your project. Let me tell you where I would like you to get me back involved. So if you have issues that it comes with X, Y, and Z, I'd like to know about it. If you have a problem with X, I'd like to know about it. If there's a ripple effect outside of your current project that goes in the organization, I'd like to know about it. Other than that, I want you to do what you feel is best. And I would encourage you to come talk to me as often as you want, because I don't see it as weakness. I think that's awesome. And I, you know, most of my top producers come to me 4 or 5 times a week, just quick question. That's perfectly fine with me. But I think if you give them the guardrails, you'll get the most out of them. Otherwise, they're only operating in this very, you know, small little window. And, you know, why hire them? They're just basically doing the work that you could be doing. So right. To me, let them grow. Yeah, let them grow. And let them make mistakes. Let them think about themselves. Mm-hmm. And listen, the hard thing is, they may not do what you would have done. And they may not have done what you want them to do. But they're probably 80% there, you know, directionally. And I think there's some phrases that we have to get good at when you're doing these guardrails. Like, well, what did you do well? Like, what went well, right? Well, what we do more of, right? And then we have the other one is, what would you do differently? What would you do differently? So it's more, better. What could you have done better? What could you do more of? And what would you have done differently? If you ask those questions on all the scenarios, people learn very, very quickly, and they self-discover. I think when you tell them all the time, this is what you need to do, different, better, whatever, it doesn't absorb, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't kick in. And then you always get frustrated as a leader because that person's doing the exact same thing you just told them not to do last month. Mm-hmm. But that's because they were listening to you, your voice, versus, well, what would you have done differently? Well, I would have done this differently. I guess what? They're not going to do that again because their ears heard what their mouth said, and it's their idea. People never argue with their own data, and guardrails allow them to have their own data and not for you to micromanage them.
You know, a very simple question that I have coached so many leaders on when something went really poorly, mm-hmm. right? And you're upset with it. You're, as the boss, you're upset with it. And you just want to go in and say, this is, these are the things that are wrong. Reframe and ask the question, how do you think that went? Get that person's feedback before you give it, before you, you know, it may really reframe the entire conversation. You know, one of my favorite, I'm a bit of a podcast geek, and one of my favorite podcasters is Jocko Willink. Mm-hmm. He wrote Extreme Ownership, and, mm-hmm. you know, I saw him speak recently. And it was a real, you know, as you know, and probably a lot of our listeners know, he's a former retired Navy SEAL commander. He's a jiu-jitsu, top level jiu-jitsu, and then also a leadership coach. And so the audience was so diverse. There were like jiu-jitsu folks, there were Navy people. Yeah. It was just, it was really, really cool. And we had the opportunity to talk to him and ask questions. And I asked around leadership competencies. And he talked about detachment, which I call self-awareness. And he said, I think I call that detachment, which is being able to sort of step out of yourself or the situation and really view what's going on. And we both shared how that's a really hard mindset, and wondering your thoughts around detachment or self-awareness and how you identify a self-aware leader or help someone become more of a self-aware leader.
Yeah, it's a tough, that's something that takes years to learn, right? And normally we've been making all the mistakes. I think the first thing that we have to do is not lead by ego. You really have to leave your ego, you know, in the other room or in the car or wherever you're going to leave it. But I think most people are leading by that ego, but also telling them indirectly without knowing actually doing it, but telling them how great they were as a leader. You know, this is what I used to do. This is what I would do. To me, I've always learned that I would always take time. Like if there was an issue, like for whatever thing, it just didn't go well. I always look at things at buckets. So my behavioral style is I'm a bucket guy. So I look at it in categories. And so I do the well, better, different, more. I do that. I do ask you for what you've gotten. But I also ask, you know, like, how did you come to that conclusion? Like, how did that happen? Like, what was your thought process? And try to figure out, because how you think about things to me is more important than the action that you did, because that can always change, right? But I wait, because like everyone else, I'm on an emotional roller coaster as well. I'm human. But then I realize that that's not going to get me anywhere. And so I'm a big talk track guy too. Like I'm a big, nothing's coming out of my mouth internally at meetings that I haven't thought about a lot. Like, you know, and of course brainstorming's different, but yeah, I've thought it through, and I thought it through from your position, the client's position. What if this, what if that? And it's almost like I'm playing chess on my own before, you know, I have to apologize for everybody for running my mouth in an inappropriate way, which tends to happen. And maybe it's because I have 5 kids, I've learned that. But, you know, I think if you can just have a little self-control occasionally and not prove that you're the greatest one in the company. And I think I've witnessed it 100 times. You know, they just want to show you how good they were during the day. But I do think self-awareness or detachment is hard. And I think it's difficult. It takes a lot of courage to do that sometimes. And I also think that good leaders are courageous 5 minutes at a time. You know?
Expand upon that a little bit.
Well, I mean, listen, we're doing things that are uncomfortable as well. And, you know, people are like, David, why? That was super uncomfortable. You handled that well. Okay, well, A, I thought about it. And I've changed my talk track two or three times because I realized it was better and better every time I thought about it. But then second, you know, I would, if you really think about it, you have to, if you look at it from different perspectives, it's just a lot easier for you to have that discussion. But if you're going to let somebody go that's just been with you for 15 years, that's hard. And so I've learned two things: blurt it out as quickly as possible. Yeah. And second, just be courageous, say what has to be said in the most respectful way, and you'll clean up your own psychological mess later. Yep. But this is the time where you need to be the leader and do what you're super uncomfortable doing because you know this person, there's an emotional attachment. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. And I just literally become a sniper in a very nice mm-hmm. way, but I just completely detach myself mm-hmm. from
that. Yeah, situation. It's really, you know, one of the things I took from my training at Sandler, which is obviously sort of part of this whole discussion, is prepare, right? You just cannot ever be sort of winging it, especially when it comes to leading. And you might find yourself 100%. In situations that you didn't expect to be in, but there's a way to not wing that and get yourself, you know, either press pause, you know, like I used to say, you know, no one's going to live or die by this conversation. So what kind of advice do you have for leaders who are struggling to build their business with leaders who are struggling with differentiating between developing people versus growing their business? We don't have time to do the development. We don't have time to step away. You know, we need to be focused on growing the business. What is your advice there?
Well, but I do, yes, and I think there's three big buckets leaders have to worry about: is building my business, building my team, building myself. Mm. And I think all three are equally as important. And I think there's a ton of overlap between the two. I think that you can build your business by creating process and things that are scalable. Mm-hmm. And then building your people on how to become better at the process. They don't have to be independent, right? So if, for instance, if you say, I've got to be really good at funnel management because my funnel is just not predictive. Okay, well, you can create, you know, exit criteria for your stages and a bunch of other stuff that you would do naturally. But you're also going to be talking to your people about how to better qualify. And it's okay to close a file. And it's okay to do those. So I think the development of your people is really how to do the things that are in your holes in the process versus some separate topic. And now you're working on 16 different balls that are in the air that are not connected with each other. And so I like to consolidate and do the connectivity first and deal with the ones that are going to help me with a better process, which is build my business, right?
Right.
So I think that's there. I also think less is more. So, you know, when you're developing your team, you should really, there's two different things going on. I've got individual gaps of my player, but I've got team gaps, right? And so most of us go right to the team gaps. And because that's, I can just do one to many. I'm going to solve one problem for many of you. And that may or may not work, but I still think you have to work on those individual gaps as well. But I think you have to have a plan. I call it a cookbook. You have to have a behavioral plan that says, if I'm going to work on my team, I'm going to work on myself as an example, or my business, then I'm going to spend 40% of my time making sure that my business is locked up. I'm going to go over here and spend 30% of my time building my team. And I'm going to spend X amount of time over here of this bucket, which is my own skill levels. And if you don't have time allotted to whatever you're trying to do, then whatever's in front of you or the biggest fire will consume your time and nothing else gets done.
Right.
So that's just fact. I mean, if you look at an individual sales producer and you say, I want them to get net new logos and go, you know, deep and wide within existing accounts, if you don't tell them, I want 60% on net new logos of your time and focus, 40% on going deep and wide with your existing client base, they will pick whatever one is the best for them, whether economically or just because I don't like the cold call, then they're going to go into whatever one they want. And you're never going to be satisfied as a leader. So one of the guardrails that we talked about earlier is give them time blocks of where you want them to spend their time, not necessarily what to do in that time block, but that's the time block I want you to do net new logos as that example is concerned.
Right.
And right. I think that's super helpful. And most leaders don't give them the time blocks.
Right. Interesting. That's a really powerful guardrail, which is saying, I'm not going to tell you how to do it. But I'm going to tell you the priority around time to get to the result that you need to get to.
That's right. And you're willing to help them, but you know, sometimes they don't want that, or you have to kind of spoon feed that depending on who you're in front of. But I think, you know, you and I both know, I bet you 80% of the leaders don't give them time blocks.
Oh, I wouldn't think so. No, absolutely.
And they're doing the best they think. And that's not what you think as my leader. That's not what you're thinking, but I think that's the most important thing. And we're already disconnected.
How does your style of leadership switch or adjust and adapt to somebody else's style?
So adaptivity. I think it's my responsibility as a leader to change the way I communicate based on the employee in front of me. I don't think it's the employee's job to change the way they communicate. I think it's my job to morph, much like it's the job of a salesperson to morph, not the buyer to morph, right? So I do think that.
Right.
But I also think that there are certain guardrails and approaches that I'm not going to deviate based on your style. But you know, I am super flexible to get the most out of you, whatever that is. I just have to figure out what that code is for you. And a lot of it is just observation and asking very direct questions. Mm-hmm. And I also think it's hard for people, like I'm on a ton of projects. I don't lead those projects. So Holly, I don't lead the projects, right? So it's really hard for new employees in Sandler when they hear me say, because they don't believe it, Holly, this is your project. I'm on the project team. Do not look at my role. I am here. I work for you. If I'm missing deadlines, you can call me out. You can tell me exactly what exactly do you want from me? What does success mm-hmm. look like for you? And when do you want it? And they're in shock. Because they expect me, because I'm a senior leader, to have a get out of jail card free. I'm just about everything. Mm-hmm. But my belief system is I will be on time at all times. Like I'm not missing deadlines because I don't expect you to do that. So I lead by example.
Right.
You know, and I want my work product to not be half, you know, to be well thought out. Yeah. To be well thought out and not because I had a deadline. So it's good enough. No way. I give you what I would expect you to give me. And I think that's unusual sometimes. You know, I have people say, I respect people being on time, but yet their meetings start 15 minutes late every time. Or, you know, they're late or they do this or they do that. I think if you're going to have expectations of others and you need to live up to those expectations yourselves, and I think we don't do that a lot.
What would, if I called five of your top team members right now, your yeah. team, what would they say is sort of your style?
My style, they would probably tell you, lay the groundwork and let you do your job. They would mm-hmm. they would probably all say that. Clarity, everybody knows where we are, just like no ambiguity, I think would be the second. The third is helping you grow, because if you're growing, then I'm growing. And I don't have a fear. If I help you grow, you leave. I'd rather have you super competent and employed with me versus incompetent and stay. So, you know, that doesn't bother me at all. I would say they would also tell you my style is asking your opinion. Like, I want to know what you know. Like, what do you think? Mm-hmm. Like, how would you solve this? Well, I don't know. Okay, but if you were king for the day, how would you do this? Well, I would do this, this, and this. It's kind of interesting how everybody has the answer sometimes, right?
Right.
Just afraid to say it. So I think that's what they would, and passionate. Like I'm super passionate about what I do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it comes across. But again, that's also a danger zone for me too, because when I'm passionate about it, they think that I'm dictating, and I'm not dictating. I'm fighting for my position. And if we're in like an open discussion, I'm fighting for what I believe, but I could be wrong. And I know that with that, I have new people. I have to say, Holly, I'm not saying that I'm right. So give me two examples of where you do not agree with me. And I have to actually say it that way. Otherwise, I'd say, well, what do you think? Well, Dave, I think that's awesome. And I know what you're saying when you hang up is that's not so awesome.
I was at a conference, and two of the last speakers were very high level assistants to two presidents from different parties. And it was such a fascinating conversation. It was Karl Rove and Valerie Jarrett. So it was Bush and Obama. Agreed on nothing except that what their leaders did was ask who doesn't agree with me. I need to know who doesn't agree with this decision. And the stories were absolutely fascinating on getting that information out, because being in such a position of power, it's very hard for someone to say, I don't agree with you. So creating that environment where somebody is allowed to disagree is really getting to that. That's was clearly a statement of what excellent leaders do. So I thought that I don't think I'll ever forget that conversation. But yeah, this has been super. I love this. I love the clarity and the the passion piece. What is your comment, if you will, to aspiring leaders? What recommendations, suggestions do you have around developing?
Yeah, I think a couple things. Don't expect your leader to be able to help you without you taking charge. What does that mean? I think you have to look. The person you report to is probably overwhelmed and may not even be paying attention to your career path. I think you have to take charge. And what I mean by that is be very clear about where you'd like to go, if you know, or be very clear that you're searching. And this is the type of help that I would like, right? So I think when you start asking people for help, they will help you. So you have to ask for help. Like I won't rescue you. But if you ask me for help, I'll do whatever you want, plus a ton of stuff that you've never asked before.
Right.
It's just human nature. So ask for the help. Be very clear about what you're looking for and where that you need the support and help. And it's okay to find multiple people. You do not have to latch on to the same person for long periods of time and only one person. I think each of us as leaders has different skill levels, and you have to look for who can help you in different areas that you can openly see they do a good job with them, then search it out. And, but for me to go find you and say, okay, look, I'm going to help you develop. Of course, I hope I do that as leaders, but I think nine out of 10 times as a developing leader, you have to look for, and we talked about it, like what skills should I have at that next job? What experiences should I have at that next job? And how do I think about it? Like, tell me the mindset of that particular leader. Like, how does that work? How do you think about certain things? And be very inquisitive, and then go search them out and be very, very upfront about what you're looking for. And I think you'll be a lot better off than, why isn't anybody helping me grow and develop? Like, I don't understand it. Well, okay. Right.
Well, there's no ownership in that kind of statement.
No,
and it's
no.
Really, it is, you know, personal. If I teach one thing to my kids, it's, you know, personal responsibility, you've got to, I'm not going to do it for you. You've got to, you know, commit, and I will help you do anything you need to do, but let's,
that's right.
Take some personal responsibility.
I think you have to manage up is your bottom line, right? You got to manage up.
I'm probably dating myself here. I believe that that's something we're missing in our current sort of in our switch of generations. It was the very first thing I learned in my career was never let my boss be surprised. Right? That was I was 21 years old. I was, I was summer birthday. So I was 21 years old, and it was somehow I knew, or I learned, that if there was a problem, you make sure that they are finding out about it from you. And, that's a tough teach these days. Yeah. Any last thoughts? Any last words of wisdom? I've really enjoyed our conversation.
I think regardless of what industry you're in, I think the role, whatever role you're in, whether what type of leader, I think just treat it as a career. Mm. You know, and I think if I use salespeople, I don't think many people spend a lot of time crafting, you know, or honing their craft. And I don't know how many people as leaders really sit down and say, hey, let me learn about behavioral styles, or how do I learn about, you know, difficult conversations? How am I doing this? We spend time working on other people's issues and not necessarily a lot of self-development stuff on what makes us better. And I think once we lose that and we're focused on all the people that work for us and not doing our own thing, I think then that's where we fall down. So I think spend some time on yourself as well.
Mm-hmm. Very purposeful in your own development and your own sort of trajectory and skill set. Thank you so much, Dave, for taking the time with us and, you know, sharing your wisdom, and all the best and lots of success, continued success. And, you know, we're big Bob Wax fans, so.
Oh, yeah, of course. He's awesome. You're in good hands. Yeah. And thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Take care. Thanks. All right, bye-bye. Hi, I'm Holly, and I'd like to thank you for listening to this episode. The Better People Podcast is brought to you by MEA. At the Mid-Atlantic Employers Association, we help organizations and their people grow through HR-driven business solutions. Find out more at meainfo.org or in the show notes.